We follow Christine down a long labyrinth of tunnels. She's being led by a mysterious dark figure. That's the Phantom of the Opera.
Everyone, and welcome back to No Script, an unscripted conversation about theater's best scripts. I'm Jackson Nikolai.
I'm Jacob Mann Christensen. We are excited to have you back for another week, another conversation about another great script. And in the case of today's episode, like a big time script, like a big time commercial theater giant. Like last week we did a like classic theater giant, like the kind of theater that we make kind of giant. This week is like more money giant.
Absolutely. Yeah, shaped the landscape of musical theater for sure in America, but also in the West End for decades and decades. Today we're talking about The Phantom of the Opera by Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Oh, you even gave him the sir. I didn't realize that we recognized the knightship on the podcast, but apparently we do. That's now lore. We recognize knightship.
We have some listeners over there in Great Britain, so yeah, we might as well throw in the title.
Just so everybody knows, I'm on the back end of a little bit of a cold. My voice is a little scratchy, a little different sounding today. That is the nature of recording a weekly podcast sometimes. Sometimes you're sick, man, and you still got to talk about Phantom of the Opera, so here we are.
Here we are. You probably won't even know. I'll edit it all out. But just in case, it's good to get
it out there. All the coughing and snot on my end is just like, we're going to be talking about it, and the audience is going to be like, what are you talking about? It sounded fine to me.
It was all fine.
Like, audio wizardry, man.
Yeah. So as
here, I'll give
it.
Everybody a little cough right now, just so that like you
there
know.
There you
I'm
go.
Like,
just to prove
real.
It.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure. Yep. So today we're talking about a play like this. We generally say this for when we start to get into the context or synopsis. But this play is ubiquitous. This play has a kind of awareness of its own. It's been adapted into so many film versions. It's so many people's first musical, or first musical that they really resonate with. So the kind of context and synopsis, we're gonna do a little bit of it, but really, like, you know, a play this size that has been on Broadway and in the West End for as long as it is, our juggernauts are things that people write whole books about. So we'll do a little bit of contextualization and synopsis around it. This play just like has, I'm excited to get to talk about it, has a life of its own. I'm sure as you saw the title of us talking about this play, you had a memory of hearing a part of this musical. It's just that ingrained into the theater scene of the last, you know, 30, 40 years.
And you may even have like a vision in your head of a sort of a candlelit scene, a tall black cloak, a white mask, a woman in a white dress. I mean, these are iconic images from American musical theater that come straight out of Hamilton really changed the game. But before that, Phantom might be up there with Les Mis as like the most well-known musical in America.
For sure.
I mean, it's you know, of course, its long-time Broadway run has recently come to a close, as I'm sure we will mention in the context section. And the fact that it has lasted so long is an incredible achievement of stage presence.
Yeah, absolutely. And also premise too. I'm excited to get into that because I think that's part of why it's lasted for so long, why so many people identify with it for so long. Excited to get into the conversation around it because I think it does have so many resonance points that have led it to be the as long-standing and long-running as it is.
I mean, I would not be shocked at all. In fact, it's probably the betting favorite to be our most popular episode of the season, right? I mean,
yeah, we'll see what happens.
It's
yeah.
that kind of episode. And so on that note, if you're here with us right now and you're not a supporter of the show, if you've stumbled into No Script because you saw Phantom of the Opera and were interested, because you're an infrequent listener when popular titles that you know pop up, you jump in. Or if you're a regular weekly listener and this is just another episode to you, all those people, if you're not a supporter yet, hope you consider it. We believe that the work we do on this podcast of just modeling, fostering, having great conversations about great scripts is an important mission. We believe in what we do. We take great joy in what we do. Unfortunately, what we do is not free. We would love it if it was, believe me. If we were rich enough that we could make a podcast week after week and it would be of no financial cost, either in time or direct dollars to us, that would be tremendous and we wouldn't be doing this plug. But that is not the case, and so we are here. Please consider visiting us at Patreon. That's patreon.com/noscriptpodcast. All one word, no hyphens, no underscores. patreon.com/noscriptpodcast. That is where you can become a supporter of the show. You'll, set up, if you've ever been on Patreon, you know, you sort of set up a monthly amount that you agree to donate to the running of the show. In our case, the lowest tier is $1 a month. That's an easy setup. It's just $1 a month. And even that is hugely valuable to us. It really makes the show possible. Those of you that are supporting the show on Patreon make what we do possible to happen on a week-to-week basis in this way. If that's not you yet, no judgment, no anything, just think about it is the ask from this show. You can check us out on patreon.com/noscriptpodcast, and we will see you over there.
Yes, thank you all so much for being patrons of the show. Head on over to patreon.com/noscriptpodcast if you want to find out more about that.
Let's see if I can do like a phantom voice on this one. And now, back to the script.
Here we go. Nicely done. Yeah, back into the script of The Phantom of the Opera. We, of course, are talking about that, and it's written by Andrew Lloyd Webber and lyrics by Charles Hart, additional lyrics by Richard Stilgo. So we're going to jump in just a little bit. We typically like to give you a little bit of introduction to the playwright as we jump into the conversation. Now, Andrew Lloyd Webber, am I right? This guy has been...
What can you say about Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Yeah, the guy has 21 musicals composed. He has prominent partnerships with lots of great writers of music and song and lyrics. Tim Rice is a notable partnership of his that he had for a long time. If you've heard musical theater for any real amount of time, you've probably run into one of his plays. Let's see. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, Cats, Starlight Express, Phantom of the Opera, School of Rock. These are the musicals of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And in fact, once I get to the play itself, this play unseated one of his other plays as the longest running play on
incredible.
Broadway. So
I mean,
yeah,
it,
just an incredible career. Yeah. Just an incredible career, incredible ability to make plays that many, many people enjoy and to tell stories in a compelling way to those many, many people. Let's see. I'm not going to spend too much time, honestly, because just the amount of resource out there about Andrew Lloyd Webber is long, and there's so much cool stuff in his career around his different partnerships and the things that he's worked on. However, he was born in 1948 in Kensington, London. He's a British playwright who's found a lot of success on the American Broadway stage. Just like so many awards and honors and things, you've heard me say the Sir. He received a knighthood back a while ago, I believe 1992. His plays have won many, many awards, many, many honors. And continue to do so with even just this most recent closing of Phantom being a pretty important moment for theater in general. I'm going to jump into
a little
bit about...
I think everybody already knows this, so I don't think I'm breaking news to anybody, but it's just such a cool story that I have to say it. As Phantom is closing right now, you are hearing the stories of pit musicians who have been in the show since it opened. I mean... Yeah. This was their career. They were pit musicians, which is a great career for musicians out there. A lot of musicians that are studying music don't know how they're going to make a career. Think about being a pit musician for musicals. It's a great career. And there are pit musicians who you know, this is what I'm going to do for my career. And then they only did one show for their whole career. I mean, that's mind-boggling. That is crazy that a show could have that kind of longevity, that it could sustain people's whole careers. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. It really is wild that a play would last that long. And then the sort of culture that is built around that is such a cool thing of kind of ongoing involvement in it. And a lot of the cast kind of like comes up from within the ranks of the cast. It's just a really, yeah, it's for anything that lasts that long creates a whole movement and community around it. And it's just super special. I'll give you just a little bit of information around the Phantom of the Opera. The play was based on a 1910 French novel by Gaston Leroux, kind of an interesting process around which Weber came up with the idea. He has a kind of long-standing partnership with Cameron Mackintosh, who is a wildly famous producer of theater, produced Cats and Les Mis. Weber was looking for a way to do another kind of romance play and came across the book version of Phantom of the Opera and kind of hit on the idea and kind of began developing it as a result of that. He also wrote the part of Christine Daae for his then wife, Sarah Brightman, and she debuted the role, played it both on the West End and in Broadway. So it's kind of it's definitely a connected play to Weber. He wrote it. It's placed in his kind of lexicon of plays after Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, after Jesus Christ Superstar, after Evita, after Cats, after Starlight Express comes Phantom of the Opera. So you get a lot of weight coming into this play. A brief note about the lyricist. It kind of went through a couple different lyricists to start with. Jim Steinman was first asked to. He wasn't able to do it. Alan J. Lerner did a little bit, and you have some of his influence, but he was pretty quickly not able to kind of complete the lyrics of the show. But Richard Stilgoe came on board, especially he was the lyricist for Starlight Express, and he did a lot of the initial lyrics for the production. However, eventually Charles Hart came on and kind of really landed on a lot of the lyrics that stand out to you today. So if you're probably thinking of a lot of Charles Hart's lyrics when you're thinking of lyrics from the play. Stilgoe and Weber as a part of this, wrote the libretto for the play. So that's kind of many hands were in the works of this play from its inception to its eventual completion. The productions of the show, it started on the West End in September of 1986, and that production is the second longest running West End production of a play. It's only beaten by Les Mis. It was recently closed, I believe, in 2020, and then was got its revival on the West End in 2021. So technically, that production ended, and yet only a year went by without Phantom being on the West End.
I don't know if that should count. The pandemic, it feels like those should be years that we just like axe out, and like that shouldn't count against it. I don't approve of that.
Well, interestingly, it didn't count against the Broadway version. And I think the distinction that is being made in the West End version is the West End is actually restaging or staging the touring company's production of Phantom of the Opera, which is just got another run at it. It got things like a slightly different set, slightly different blocking, etc. So it wasn't a continuous production. Rather, it's bringing in the new production versus the Broadway production, which did remain the same, used the same set, Nothing was measurably changed during the pandemic break, and so it got its status, which I'll mention now. The Phantom of the Opera on Broadway opened in 1988, and closed. A month ago, in my timeline, when you're listening to it, it might be a couple weeks later, but closed a month ago in April of 2023. Here's just a couple stats for you. It's the longest running Broadway production, followed up by, oh dear, I forgot. I'll remember it in a moment. but followed up by about a 3,000 play gap between the next play that was in the lineup.
Not even close, man.
Not even close. Yep.
Think about how many performances that is. You perform six times a week, perhaps. Not 6 days a week, of course, but you have double show days. So, you know, I think an average week is 5 or 6 performances a week. It's by thousands of performances.
Yeah. It's wild. Yeah, I think it closed with 13,900 some performances. And I just remembered that it's followed closely behind by the 1996 revival of Chicago on Broadway. So it's wild when it became the longest running show on Broadway, it beat Cats as the longest running show on Broadway. So there you go. There's just a little bit of knowledge about how successful it's been on Broadway. It was also the first play to surpass 10,000 performances on Broadway. So definitely highly produced play. There's been plenty of other plays. Let's see. We've got a Australian cast. We've got there's a Las Vegas cast. There is lots of different people in these roles and such. Of course, this play is highly lauded. So Michael Crawford and Sarah Brightman are the kind of duo that pioneered the role of the Phantom and Christine Daae. Michael Crawford won a bunch of awards for that role. Of course, the first opening year had plenty of Tonys assigned to the role, one best play, many, many other honors and things, and continues to do so. All the revivals and all the things continue to win honors and such like that. Kind of the last, just kind of mostly piece of trivia that I'll give you, but it's one that I love, is the Royal Albert Hall did a production of the cast as a 25th of this play as a 25th anniversary. And that production starred Ramin Karimlo and Sierra Bogues. A great show. Some of it was recorded. You can find it in places and things like that. I saw a couple clips that they had posted on YouTube. Great performances by both of those two. I want to just note that Ramin Karimlo is the only actor, I believe this is true, I don't think there's a way that this cannot be true or could have been updated, the only actor to have played all three significant men in Christine Daae's life, because he played the Phantom in this 25th anniversary. He's played Raoul before in various productions. And he also cameoed in the film version as the picture of Christine Daae's father. So he has the distinction because he also pioneered the kind of follow up play, the sequel play to this, which I'm forgetting the name, but there's another sequel to Phantom of the Opera. And he played the Phantom in that. And so I believe he was playing it at the time of the filming of the movie. And so they brought him in as this kind of cameo as Daae's father. So that's kind of a fun distinction for him. He's a great actor. He's obviously played in Plenty of Phantom, and he's done a lot of Les Mis as well. Just a kind of fun trinket of information for this play that has gone on for so long, has tons of, I mean, just imagine how many people's stories intersect around this play, whether you're in the pit, whether you're in the cast or served or had some time in the cast, whether it was the play that you kind of first connected with when you started getting into musical theater. This play has 35 years of connecting people's stories around this music and this story.
Well, I mean, we've done popular shows before. I mean, we've done In the Heights. We've done Hamilton. I don't think we've done Les Mis on the podcast, but I think is our first real foyer into something of this scale. Not this scale historically. I mean, of course, we've done Greek plays and Shakespeare. I mean, we've done a lot of historically grand things. But I think you put it a really interesting way there at the end. Like, the number of people's lives that have come around this musical, I think, has to be greater than virtually anything else that we've talked about. Even though some of the things we've talked about are so much older, Phantom has had such has swept in, I mean, 35 years ago, and has become the thing. And it's sort of one of those things that you don't think about a lot. Like, it just floats in and out, and then you come to it again, and you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot that this musical is a huge freaking deal. It's a huge deal.
Yeah.
And it was actually, I think it was the closing of it this year that reminded a lot of us how big of a deal this musical is.
Yeah. Interestingly, part of a musical closing is that it either needs a fresh take or something like that, or needs a change of venue, or the ticket sales are going down, et cetera. And there was a slight dip in ticket sales for Phantom, after COVID, all the reasons. But as soon as they announced that it would be closing for the first time in 35 years, just full houses skyrocketed. Everyone knew that they had to get in on it, and pushed what was a February close date to an April close date. So that's another kind of fascinating element of people's connection with it.
Yeah, I'm going to just run through the synopsis of this plot fairly efficiently, I hope. It's kind of a plot-heavy musical. Big musicals tend to be. Imagine trying to describe the plot of Les Mis. Phantom is simpler than that. So I'm not going to do a very thorough job. I'm just going to try to hit the highlights. I think a lot of people know this or have a vague idea of what it's about. Musical opens, of course, this is at the end of the 19th century at various times. Musical opens with an auction being held. We are in France, and the auction is being held to auction off various props, costumes, furniture, items from this opera house that is closing. They auction off various items in the prologue, but of course we finally come to the ending one, which is the chandelier. A chandelier that the auctioneer describes as being the chandelier from the famous Phantom of the Opera incident. It might still be haunted. Ooh. And then we move into, back in time, to that sort of, well, the events around that chandelier. Look, I find Phantom to be just a hair long. I'd probably cut the prologue. Hot take. I don't know exactly what it really adds to the musical. I think you probably could start at the top of Act One and it'd be a pretty darn good musical. 1881, an opera house in Paris. We are in rehearsals for one of the several different operas that are produced across the course of this play. At the top of the show, the main singer, the main female singer for this opera is Carlotta, and they are rehearsing a scene, various scenes throughout. There's dancers. One of those dancers is named Christine. Those are going to be two characters you're going to want to know here in a second. As they're rehearsing, the new owners wander in. The opera house is being sold. They wander in. They want Carlotta to sing a little solo from the song for them because she's the star. As she's singing it, a backdrop falls down and everybody goes, "Oh, the Phantom of the Opera is here. Oh my gosh." And Carlotta says, "Unless you, the new owners, can deal with this freaking ghost that's just around causing chaos and accidents and injuries and all kinds of dangerous stuff, I'm out." And she pieces out. And the new owners say, "Man, it's our first night owning the opera and our star left. What are we going to do? We're going to have to cancel." And one of the dancers says, "No, Christine can sing the part. She has an amazing voice. She's being tutored by a mysterious genius." And Christine steps up, sings the same solo that Carlotta sung, and of course does it beautifully and better. Skip ahead to the performance where Christine is now in the leading role because Carlotta walked out. The patron of the theater, the person funding the new owners, is named Raoul. He is there watching. He realizes, "That's my friend from when we were children, my old flame." And so after the performance, they meet backstage. Raoul and Christine say, "Oh my gosh, we after all these years." And you can tell that, of course, this is going to be the love interest for the show. Christine mentions that she's being tutored by the Angel of Music, whatever that means. Raoul takes off, says he's going to come right back. And then Christine gets, I mean, I think, legitimately hypnotized, and she disappears into her own mirror. Yes, very mysterious. And Raoul returns to find that she's not there. We follow Christine down a long labyrinth of tunnels. She's being led by a mysterious dark figure. That's the Phantom of the Opera. Christine follows the Phantom down these dark tunnels across a lake. First of all, I mean, there's an underground lake under this opera house. I mean, that seems like somebody should get that taken care of. I don't know how safe that is. The Phantom and Christine take the boat across the lake to the Phantom's lair, where Christine faints. She wakes up the next morning, and the Phantom is composing his new magic opera, and she comes up behind him and removes his mask. He gets very upset because she's seen his face, and we learn, although we don't see, that his face is quite disfigured. We learn why more later, and we don't exactly know the cause of the disfigurement, but just that it's quite severe. And so now we're back into the office of the opera house. The managers and Carlotta and a bunch of folks have received letters. These letters are from the Phantom of the Opera, who has demanded that they put on a new opera. They put Christine as the lead, is his thing now, instead of Carlotta. Everybody refuses. Of course, they're the new owners. He's not going to boss us around. So then at the performance, as Carlotta is in the lead, instead of Christine, which the Phantom demanded, the Phantom appears and makes Carlotta's voice into a croaking frog. Then he crashes the chandelier, yes, the same chandelier from the auction, and kills a dude.
Yep.
He's a murderer. It's like a kind of a Star Trek, like, red shirt kind of guy. Like, they introduce him, and you're kind of like, oh, that's the guy he's going to kill. And, of course, he does die. And that is the end of Act 1. Act 2, it's 6 months later. They have a masquerade ball. We learned a couple of things. Christine and Raoul are now secretly engaged, which is, of course, going to piss off the Phantom because he is in love with Christine. The Phantom appears at the masquerade ball. Of course, there's a whole bunch of, like, kind of thematic singing about the nature of masks and hiding things. And the Phantom appears and drops off his new opera that he's just finished, hot off the presses, and demands that everyone at his opera house, he has some feeling of ownership over it, performs his opera, and that Christine be the lead. And because his opera is so hard to sing, she needs to continue lessons with him. We learn around here that someone in the group, I believe it's the dance instructor, knows the backstory of the Phantom, which is that he was paraded around as a kind of circus freak for most of his life. In a cage, mobs would come and throw things and hate him and yell at him. But he was a genius, but he had this, whatever the disfigurement of his face is, that causes him to, you know, in the time, be a circus freak. Of course, now we see what that does to people, and in some ways, this musical is about what that does to people. But he escaped and has been haunting the opera house ever since. The troupe, the managers, Raoul, Christine, everybody decides, you know what? We're going to perform the new opera, and Christine's going to be the lead, and we're going to use it as a trap to kill the Phantom. So they do so. But instead of trapping and killing the Phantom steals Christine away, kills the guy playing Don Juan, his musical is Don Juan, and the Phantom escapes into his subterranean lair with Christine, pursued by Raoul first, and then at some distance behind him, a large angry mob who are rightly angry that he's been murdering people. Down in the dungeon lair Phantom area, Raoul shows up where the Phantom has been trying to singingly seduce Christine, which seems odd given that he just killed a guy, but that's his plan, as such as it is. And Raoul arrives and says, you must let Christine go. And the Phantom traps Raoul in this sort of strange noose device that he's used a bunch of times. And basically says to Christine, you better agree to love me and stay with me forever, or I'm going to kill Raoul. And in the sort of final confrontation, Christine goes to the Phantom and shows him kindness and kinship and kisses him. Some problematic stuff there, of course, but it's, you know, it's a musical from almost 40 years ago. And she kisses him, and that kiss, you know, unlocks the icy depths of his heart. And he lets Raoul and Christine go, and as the angry mob appears, the Phantom disappears disappears like into his cloak and leaves his mask behind. The Phantom, of course, coming from this circus background, has all these crazy stage tricks that he uses throughout. Can make fire appear. The little noose lasso thing that he uses is a kind of stage trick, and he can kind of appear and disappear at different times. And so the final thing is one last disappearing act into his cloak, leaving behind his mask, and that is the end of the musical.
Yeah, nicely done. Yeah, like you said, a pretty plot heavy, necessary action sort of play. Things lead to the other really well, and push on the next thing, and push on the next thing, and you go on the ride the whole time. And then, like, just to like kind of note the kind of like flagships or the respawn points or whatever you want to say, like the checkpoints along the way, are these musical numbers that kind of continually advance, especially the duo of the Phantom and Christine, and then kind of throw in the triangle of Raoul into that combination as well. So you have big songs like, of course, Phantom of the Opera, Music of the Night. You have All I Ask of You, the Don Juan triumphant song that leads into Point of No Return. All of these songs are these big show off moments where characters are trying to exert some sort of power over the other. Oftentimes it's the Phantom trying to exert power over the other, but over Christine and forcing Raoul out of the equation. But oftentimes you have Christine also. The Point of No Return is a great song to study for two characters who have power over each other and don't know all the pieces of the power that they have over each other, negotiating who wins that power. So yeah, all these musical numbers are tied into that really necessary driven plot that you just weighed out.
Yeah, I mean, this is a musical that follows, I think, a very familiar premise, to your point. It is this kind of you know, brilliant, genius male character who is ugly for some, you know, in some sort of societally unacceptable way, who falls in love with the most beautiful, talented woman and pursues her despite the fact that she doesn't really ever have any potential of being in love with him. And it's different versions of this story are framed in different ways. This is kind of a mythological tale in Western society. The ugly genius who is pursuing the beautiful, you know, talented young woman who's never going to love him, and different things in different ways. It's just, you know, in some ways, you could look at something like Beauty and the Beast, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Lots of sort of mythological tales like that. And then in this one, the Phantom is perhaps more creepy and more violent and, you know, more manipulative than in other versions of the tales. Whereas if you look at some versions of this myth, this most basic sort of archetypal setting, the male character is a kind of hero. An underdog, sort of scrappy underdog fighting against society. And this version, this staging of this archetype, at the very best, the Phantom is a kind of anti-hero. And at the worst, he's the villain of the piece.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, for sure. The kind of the little bit of justification we get from Madame Giry about, well, he's only lived a life of pain, and thus this is how he's turned out, gives you some justification for the compassion and kindness showed to him being the key that kind of flips him at the end. But I don't, I don't buy that it gives like full justification for all of his actions. Neither do I think the play is necessarily selling that. That said, there's some deeply troubling elements of this play that it is selling. The kind of mentor ingenue relationship between the Phantom and Christine is deeply problematic. It's definitely predatory at times, depending on different stagings of things. The physicality of those two characters is really, really pronounced. We generally try to keep most of our conversations around theater's best scripts pretty positive about things. This is a piece of this one that I'll just name as not a positive thing. And I think Phantom of the Opera can take it. It's a very successful show. But but this is a tough part of the subject matter of Phantom of the Opera, even as it's kind of continued to be a pretty popular musical, that there's a very real just stalking, some gaslighting that happens, and also the quick turn at the start of the play, because at the start of the play, you have this sense, you talked about myths of these people, and I think that's pretty appropriate. You have the wondering of, is this Phantom of the Opera like some sort of spirit or some sort of phantom? And for a good chunk of the first, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes of the play, it's hard to imagine this because we've had 35 years of this play being in our minds. But for the first like 20, 30 minutes of the play, it's structured to make you ask the question, is this a spirit? Is this in fact like some sort of god of music that is just kind of in search of a muse, etc.? And then there's a turn. The first time the mask comes off, as you get more and more information, you discover, oh no, this is just a person, a very talented, genius person who has been left alone and is kind of infatuated very unhealthily with this ingenue that he's been training for a long time. And so that journey is a stark one, and is a riff on the mythological theme that you described a little bit, and is one that has received some justified critique.
Yeah, well, absolutely, right? I mean, I think that if you were in the business of trying to identify what is uncomfortable about this relationship, this sort of setting for a plot, you would be, you know, I mean, boy, is the best case version stalker and the worst case version like rapist, right? I mean, I don't believe that we have an indication that he sleeps with her, but that's certainly his goal, and he's willing to blackmail her to do it at the end of the show. Now, he doesn't do that, and I think the idea is that the Phantom makes a redeeming choice to let them go at the end of the musical, that it ends because someone finally showed him kindness, like willing, genuine kindness. Of course, he's blackmailed because her boyfriend, her fiance, is currently, you know, strung up by a noose, but ignore that for a second and imagine that it's like willing, sure, sure, genuine kindness. And that is, I suppose, the way that the story is built to end. But I mean, between then and there, there is a lot of manipulation. I mean, murder, just straight up murders,
for sure,
two people in the course of a show.
Yeah. Definitely, like Phantom as villain is not a long journey to make. Yeah, not a hot take. A compassionate villain at times. Like you can see how he got there, but a villain. And the journey of overthrow for him, I think, is why some of the not the only reason why, but a big portion of why this story is compelling is watching Christine overthrow the thrall that he tried to place on her. Over and over, she kind of, there's the kind of first scene where she's, yeah, hypnotized is a great way to put it. You put it that way in the kind of intro, where she finally sees this teacher of hers for the first time and is kind of drawn into this wild world that he's showing her and all this stuff. And really from that moment on, when she takes the mask off, sees him, and he freaks out at her, she gives the mask back and he takes her back up. From that moment on, she's trying to get out of there somehow. she's kind of tied into the system and trying to figure out some way to get out. But she quickly kind of entrusts Rawl with some of her trust and her love, and tries to negotiate her way out of there. But every time the Phantom shows up, it kind of undermines A, she's trusted this figure for so long, and B, he's this awful person very frequently. And so you have the graveyard scene as another, where she goes and tries to find her father or sing to her father. And both the Phantom and Rawl show up at that one, and she chooses Rawl in that moment. And that leads us to the Point of No Return song, where she outsmarts the Phantom and then she's dragged down again and again at the very end, showing him compassion is her choice and the way that she gets them out of the situation. And I think that's a really compelling to watch Christine's journey through this play of kind of overthrowing this power that the Phantom has over her is a really compelling part of this musical.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. I don't love that she kisses him at the end. It feels like it's one of those things where we're turning the like a romantic. Like here, maybe this is how I'll say it. This is going to be a hot take. Oh boy, we might get in trouble for this. the Phantom in today's, today, you could probably do a version of Phantom where he's like an incel, right? Like one of those dudes who's like, nobody likes me and, women don't pay any attention to me and so I hate everything. And I'll murder, and I'll plunder, and I'll blackmail to get everything that I want. And, if that was your reading of the musical, at the end of the musical, of course, it's like this woman finally shows him. I mean, I guess you wouldn't have to make the kiss sexual, but, a kiss on the lips in our society is a generally romantic sort of sexual gesture. And that's the thing that finally like unlocks his icy heart. I don't know. If I were staging it, maybe she'd kiss him on the head. Maybe I'd ignore that. I'm not quite sure. But to me, that is the part that becomes the like, I don't know about what the message of the Phantom's reign of terror actually is. I do think that the story that is being intended to write, even though there's some translation issues across culture because of the musicals, from almost 40 years ago. But I think the story the musical means to tell is, if you deprive a person of any human comfort, you turn them into, if you deprive them of social engagement and comfort and kindness and all you give them is hatred and mobs and you lock them in a cage, you turn them into a person who will try to get that human comfort by any means that they can, even uncomfortable means. And I mean, you would say, I think you could very clearly, I almost think there's almost no argument to the contrary, that the Phantom has experienced a significant amount of trauma in his life, a significant amount of very serious trauma. The trauma of being paraded around in a cage at a circus for people to call a freak and throw things at him. I mean, that is serious trauma. The dude needs some therapy. I mean, for real.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. and has chosen to amongst the many things that he chose to do, including some fairly nefarious things, he has chosen to express a lot of that through music, which is a really interesting, a really kind of compelling at least initially when you're dealing with this character. And I think kind of prolongedly too, the Phantom is often seen by audiences as this somewhat sympathetic character. And it's because of this, the music of the night, I think, is about as sympathetic as the Phantom gets. This really compelling song where he's talking about the music of the night and trying to get Christine to see the connection points and the openness that it can allow and the kind of worldview that he's trying to craft as a result of his music. The only way he can possibly fulfill what he has dreamed about for this music is for her to sing it. That's a really compelling mode for the Phantom to be in. It's quickly followed up by a lot of other stuff, but that's a really, I think that's why. That and also just the romantic nature of this play. I don't think there's a way, honestly, maybe you could stage it with a kiss on the head or something like that, but there's like this play is made for chemistry between Christine and the Phantom. Any production, almost any production you look up, there's lots of physical contact between them. There's lots of the lyrics of the songs have lots of seductive lyrics in them. There is this question, this tension in the play of, will she, won't she? Will they, won't they? Will Raoul and her or not? There's a lot of this sexual tension in this play that builds and builds through the music and through the action of it.
Yeah, I think I've always seen in this play that the Phantom has some sort of like hypnotic ability that is part of his array of tricks. acts, right? I mean, it's the whole deal of the Phantom is that this person, I think because of touring with the circus, knows all of these stage tricks, knows how to make fire fling at people, knows how to appear and disappear, knows how to use trap doors, knows how to all this stuff, right? Knows how to make his lasso thing look like it's hovering in thin air. And then at the end of the play, he accidentally breaks that trick, right? It's part of the whole deal. He accidentally burns the thread that is, you know, supposed to be hidden and holding up the lasso, and that is the thing that happens at the end. So it's like these sort of stage tricks are part of the Phantom's persona, and I think I've always understood, maybe wrongly, that the Phantom has actually hypnotized Christine in some sort of stage trickery way, and that is where some of the singing that sounds more romantic and it's less romantic and more hypnotic. I mean,
romantic from him. That's an interesting. I think it could also, like, definitely hypnotic, could also just be manipulation. Sure. and ways of doing that can make you feel in a certain, like, you could definitely read either one of those, just his kind of raw charisma as this sort of hypnosis that he drops over. Both I think that'd be a valid way to approach it for sure.
Yeah, I want to turn our attention just a little bit to one of the places where I think some of the sort of theme writing of the musical is being done. The masquerade ball at the beginning of Act Two, I mentioned in my synopsis, has all of this sort of writing around the nature of masks and of hiding things. I mean, here is just some of the lines that the chorus sings at the top of Act Two. Masquerade, paper faces on parade, masquerade, hide your face so the world will never find you. I'm just going to start skipping around. Look around, there's another mask behind you. Fool and king, ghoul and goose, green and black, queen and priest, face of beast. Take your turn, take a ride on the merry-go-round in an inhuman race. Masquerade, take your fill, let the spectacle astound you. Stop and stare at the sea of smiles around you. Seething shadows, breathing lies, but the face will still pursue you. I think we're unpacking, it is obviously a very deliberate choice in a musical where the main villain, whatever, is masked as a major feature of his persona, that Act Two begins with a large masquerade ball where everyone is masked and where they sing this choral piece about the nature of wearing a mask, what it means to hide yourself, to cloak yourself behind something that is deliberately not you in an effort to conceal, to protect, to blah, blah.
Yeah. It's definitely like one of the moments when the mask of the Phantom gets the most moral's the wrong word, but like the point lands home of some of this stuff. Like, yeah, you might be judging this Phantom for wearing his mask all the time to cover up what he doesn't want to see, but how often do you really show up without a mask on? And naming all of these different roles and things like that. And both the so certainly naming it as a way of naming some culpability, how we show up in that way. But also that song has this kind of like, and isn't it all just so fun? And this sort of nature of what if for tonight we put on the mask? Sometimes you put it on too much. Sometimes there's these crazy people out there who throw on masks all the time and scare us. But for tonight, you get to be that mask wearer. Is such an interesting, it's an interesting song because it's one of the most, I think probably the most frivolous song in the musical, the most spectacular song, one of the most spectacular
songs. They do
float songs
in a boat across an underground lake.
for sure. But yeah, it has that note of frivolity, and especially with the juxtaposition of the Phantom showing up and giving his ultimatum in the flesh to all of them, it has this big old swing in it from this big point about masks into the emergence of the avatar of the mask for this particular play.
Well, yeah, and of course, I think then that masquerade ball is set inside a larger context, which is that this is a theater troupe, an opera troupe, I guess, technically.
And yeah.
Any play or musical in which there is a play or musical inside of the play or musical is a piece in some ways about plays or musicals. The nature of performance, of pretending. And so the masquerade ball is a kind of... is a scene in which what this troupe does throughout is commented on. Because I think it goes by us that the Phantom is playing a character, of course. It has a mask on, right? Theater masks are like, they are theater in some ways. What's the little like logo for the theater, right? If the theater, capital T, the theater, had a logo, it would be those two stinking masks, which are so annoying.
Yeah.
The smile mask and the frowny mask, right? Masks are in some ways emblematic of the theater, of this thing that we do, this strange thing where we stand up in front of people and we pretend to be someone else. And that goes by us in this show, I think. It's just part of the fabric of the play, that this is an opera troupe. But the Phantom is just doing that, using stage tricks in the same way that they use stage tricks. And there are several kind of notable stage tricks used in the operas that they stage, which I think are supposed to draw some comparison. And then you get to this masquerade ball, and as you've noted, it's this sort of light, frivolous, bouncy, joyful moment. And I think it's the moment where they converge the most closely. Where, as you said, they comment on like how attractive, how desirable putting on a mask is.
Yeah. And how, the theater as the kind of like... gathering point for that, as a place that you just kind of assume, or not assume, but yes and baby, accept, I think is the word that you use, accept that this is the way, this is gonna happen. Like, we're gonna see people take on different personas. It's gonna be real, but not real at the same time. And just sort of all that sort of, catch 22, not catch 22, but the both things held together of that, comes to bear in that song. And really this whole, like the whole musical, I feel like, deals in that acceptance really uniquely for musicals. Amongst musicals, one of the biggest critiques you get of people who are not theater people of a musical is, I just can't stand that people burst into song all the time. It just doesn't make any sense. And I feel like this musical does about as good a job as any musical does about justifying the breaking into song all the time. And that's because partially it's set in an opera house. They're singing all the time, but it's also, because there's an angel of music in it. It's because, the primary way that Christine, interacts with the world is through her music. Each time someone is in song, which is most of the musical, there's not a lot of just spoken lines in this play. Is a very justifiable moment within the context and parameters of the show, which I think is also why this show has had so much mass appeal, is people show up to it and are like, the dissonance doesn't happen as readily, I feel like, of like, why are we singing again? We could have just said this in like 30 seconds. It's not as short a journey to that, I feel like, within the parameters of the show.
Yeah, I think it's really effective, and actually Andrew Lloyd Webber, in a lot of his work, is incredibly effective at this. Think about, I'll make my point and then I'll make the other example. My point is that Andrew Lloyd Webber is very effective at creating a world, and that we just kind of live into it's like a total thing a total package that he offers us. And within the rules of that world, we don't have to accept anything. This weird Paris opera house where all this weird stuff happens and people sing all the time, and it all feels part of the thing that Weber has imagined. And if you want proof that he is so stinking good at that he's so stinking good at that that sometimes the thing that he creates is ridiculous and it still becomes one of the most popular musicals ever. Of course, I'm talking about Cats.
Right.
I mean, you want proof of that guy's mastery at selling you on the idea that, like, within this little world of a musical I've created, the rules don't matter. And we'll just buy into everything. It's a freaking musical where cats sing and dance about a strange cat ceremony where one of them is going to go to cat heaven. I mean, it's like... And it became one of the longest-running musicals of all time. And the Phantom of the Opera is like, there's these masks, and there's the strange hypnotic power of music, and those are all like part of this mysterious planet that we're visiting, that is candlelit, and where underground lakes are everywhere, and where a white mask can, you know, has a persona and a sense of place. I mean, it's so incredible what he is able to create, living and breathing through music and words on paper.
Yeah, it's really true. This, as is predictable, I think for our podcast, this was a great like dive into the underpinnings of the play. And we're coming down to the end of the time that we have. But also just the musicality of this piece. We talked about it briefly at the start of the show. Just like it's a difficult musical show. there's some really the songs themselves are like there's big jumps happening. It's kind of opera.
I think I joked beforehand that like they're not gonna cast Russell Crowe in this one, you know. It's just not gonna happen. It's just too hard to sing.
It is very hard to sing.
And sorry, Russ.
The degree to which it just stirs emotions out of the characters and out of the people watching, the way that the music soars, and speaks to the emotional struggle that the characters are going through, just makes it one of those things that is going to be certainly earworms for a while, but is going to have like just continued going down memory lane whenever you hear a strain of Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, to come full circle, Phantom of the Opera is itself so grandly. I don't know, I'm not even sure like what I mean by that sentence, other than like where we started with saying that if you picture Phantom of the Opera, you can hear those chords, right? Ba 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 ba. And I'm not a great singer, but something like those chords. And with that comes the rest of the world. You see the candlelit stage. You see the underground lake. You see the mask and the cloak. You see Christine in the white blue dress that she wears in every production because, you know, it's been running for 35 years.
So it's the same costume design for 35 years.
Same costume design. I mean, it is itself on a grand scale, and it's incredible for being that. And you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber does that so much better than almost anyone else. I mean, I'm somebody who thinks that Sondheim is probably the best musical mind that we have known, at least in the West. And even someone who's a Sondheim fanatic like myself has to say, boy, tip your hat to Andrew Lloyd Webber. I'm not sure that Sondheim could do what Webber did in this way.
It is a musical that is like just inundated into so much of theater culture, and become so endemic. Kudos to it for 35 years and 13,000 plus performances on Broadway. It's gonna hold that record for a while, I'm guessing.
How many fans of Phantom of the Opera do you think are still listening right now? We started with the criticism of like the creepy, you know, near sexual assault that is the sort of core of this play. How many do you think were just like, wow, what doofuses? stopped listening right there, and then they missed like the fact that we like waxed poetic about Lloyd Webber and the musical for about the last 15 minutes. But they just missed that. We should have started there in hindsight, and then we just like slipped the critique in as we go.
We tried to compliment sandwich, I think, and we kind of like had a lot of stuffing for the sandwich. Well, we are at the end of our time. If you are still listening and are a Phantom of the Opera fan and either been in the show, seen the show, just liked the music, listened to it, saw it, read it, any version of being a part of the story of the Phantom of the Opera, we'd love to continue having a conversation with you. One of the fun things about this podcast is we bring scripts to bear that are often not in the limelight. And it's a real great gift to do that and to have conversations about it and extend the conversation out to everyone. And it is sometimes proclivative because you haven't read that particular script. In this case, you more than likely have interacted with this script, and we'd love to chat with you about it. So find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at the username at NoScriptPodcast. We'd love to chat with you. We'd also love to curate a space in which other folks can chat with each other around a play too. So that's a great way to do it. We also have a Gmail, noscriptpodcast@gmail.com. Find us at any of those places. We'd love to keep talking about the Phantom of the Opera with you.
Absolutely. If you liked this episode or any of our other episodes, please recommend the podcast to your family, your friends, anybody you know that likes scripts, stories, conversations around how the making of a piece of theater works, themes, characters. We talk about a lot of stuff. Send them our way. We are on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, and of course other podcast places. You know, just whatever your favorite podcast place is. I'm sure we've got an RSS feed that feeds there. So check us out. You can also like us on Facebook, and a link to the new episode is just published right onto our Facebook page every Monday as we publish. We are coming up to the end of the season. We'll have more information about that and what is to come for No Script soon, I hope. Until then,
yes.
Thanks for listening to No Script the Podcast. I'm Jacob Mann Christensen.
And I am Jackson Nikolai. We will see you again next week.